Hey everybody, this is DJ Davis, and I'd like to welcome you to Tasting Notes, a podcast out of New Orleans about New Orleans people's two favorite topics, food and music. Music and food, but I'm talking with chefs about music and interviewing musicians about food. Today's guest is culinary lion, Chef Frank Brightson. In part one, we discuss Frank's humble beginnings as a sandwich maker at Blimpie's and his appreciation of the modern jazz scene in the 70s, hanging out at Lou and Charlie's. In part two, I get to ask him about cooking for the Rolling Stones, and he shares his stories about being personal chef for Mr. Bruce Springsteen. And we talk about how to cook softshell crab. In part three, I have the temerity to share my preparation for pan-seared black drum, and Chef approves. And throughout the interview, Frank, he stays on topic. He keeps bringing up the correlation and the relation between food and music, and also how precious our culture in New Orleans is. It's a conversation that runs about an hour, but I think we go through some great stuff, and I hope you enjoy it. Here we go, episode two of DJ Davis's Tasting Notes, brought to you by Blue Plate Mayonnaise.
Thank you, Davis. So happy to be here with you.
Yeah, this is great. So we're going to start off talking a little bit about some origins and stuff, because there is an active and a passive element to both food and music, because, you know, as a musician, you can make music, but you enjoy listening to music. And as a cook, you enjoy making food, but you also enjoy eating food. So talk to me a little bit. First of all, I'm going to go not from the benefit of like not having dived into Wikipedia or anything. You're from New Orleans, right?
I am. Born and raised here in New Orleans, born on Napoleon Avenue, and fourth generation New Orleanian.
Okay. And where you went to high school?
De La Salle.
All right. Class of?
72.
Tell me a little bit about your first, at your home, what was the first thing you cooked, or did you do any cooking around the house?
I really did not cook too much at home. My dad referred to me as the sandwich king, and there's still a lot of truth to that. But like a lot of people in my generation, I kind of fell into the restaurant business, you know, at a young age during my college years.
Okay, and that was your first place you worked at was?
I was at LSU,
right.
72. Mm-hmm. And some friends of mine were working at a sandwich shop called Blimpie Base.
Is that Blimpie's? Like there was a
Blimpie's.
That was a chain, right?
Yep, it was a chain from the Northeast, and it was the first Blimpie's in Louisiana.
Holy smokes, they had a Blimpie's on Carrollton Avenue, am I right?
They did.
Yes. Wow.
Yeah.
That'll take you. Yeah. That'll take you back. So you started off at Blimpie's, and where'd you go to college for?
I was majoring in fine arts.
Okay.
And
so you did art in high school. You did painting or drawing?
Painting, drawing, and printmaking.
Okay.
And I had to support myself, basically. I got some money from my mom, but I had to work. And so I wound up in restaurants. And after Blimpie's, I moved across the street to a place called the Spaghetti Store, which is kind of like a casual pasta place. And I was a cook there for a while and became night manager and stuff.
This is bringing me up memories, and I'm just a smidge younger than you, but the old Spaghetti Factory?
No, different.
Different.
This was an operation owned by Dobbs House that used to do all the airline foods.
Okay.
And it was, you know, quick and casual. And but I learned there that I really enjoyed being in the kitchen.
So it was no formal culinary training. It was all on the job.
Yeah, I didn't even know there were culinary schools, Davis. one of my best friends, Addie Herbert, sophomore year, said, "I'm leaving. I'm going to the CIA." I'm like, "What?"
This is back when the CIA was bad.
Yeah. It turned out he meant the Culinary Institute of America, which I never heard of. And so, you know, and that's how dramatically things have changed, you know. Now culinary schools, I think, do a lot because of the Food Network, introduce a lot of young people to the profession.
Right.
And they chose it as a profession. And that's helped the industry because it's more education.
I guess so. I mean, in the brief 6 months I was working with Chef Neil Swidler at Emeralds, and people kept asking me, like, where'd you go to school? Where'd you go to school? I was like, everything I know I learned from my grandmother.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of, that's kind of how we did it. So, wow, so De La Salle in the 70s, tell me about some of the music you were seeing back then.
Well,
drinking age was 18.
Right.
There were no dating apps, so people had to, in order to meet girls or boys, you know, whatever you're into, people would have to go out, see music. That was the golden era of the warehouse?
That came a little later.
Okay.
But I was definitely there. I really, you know, I think for a lot of us, we have someone that really turned us on to music in some way. And for me, it was my other best friend, Conway. He had an older cousin named Bootsy. Mm-hmm. And Bootsy lived in Baton Rouge, too, and he was an artist. He was an abstract painter. And we went to visit him. This is in the early 70s. And we sat down on the floor of his living room because there was no furniture, and there's just these huge paintings all over, and he lit a candle and started spinning albums on his turntable. And the first one was a new band, first album from this new band called Led Zeppelin.
Oh, wow.
That's how old I am. But eventually, and there was some incense burning.
Okay. Well, there were twofold albums.
Yes.
There was a reason why the albums had two folds.
Yes.
Because there was still seeds in the incense,
that's
as it were.
That's right.
Exactly.
That's how you clean your pot.
That's
and after another stick of incense, he got into what he really enjoyed, which was jazz.
Oh, nice.
And this had to be 73.
Okay.
And he introduced us all to John Coltrane.
Oh, wow.
And McCoy Tyner, and uh-huh. Rahsaan Roland Kirk, and Miles Davis. And so that began
my head-over-heels
relationship with jazz.
Oh, yeah, man. And this was kind of the point. I mean, although Miles said this, that was when he was starting to go electric, which was kind of like maybe pissing off all the purists. But for people who are also listening to Led Zeppelins and Pink Floyds, it was possibly like a...
That's right.
Miles, it was a segue that made some sense.
Yeah, Miles went rogue. I mean, he was such an adventurous artist, and he did, yeah. So I went head over heels. I spent most of my money at the record store in my college years. You know, a lot of it in what was called the cutout bin back then.
All right, yeah.
You could get these albums nobody else wanted for a dollar. But I built a collection of hundreds and hundreds of records, rock and roll and jazz. And so when I moved back, well, actually during that time, mm-hmm. When I was still at college, we found out about a place called Lou and Charlie's. Charlie Baring.
Charlie Baring, man, yeah.
Yes. And this club on Such Rampart a- Street, small place, mm-hmm. and we would come down, my wife and I was married in college, just to go to Lou and Charlie's. And oh my God, it was incredible. Earl Turbinton.
Mm-hmm. Ellis,
Willie T. Ellis Marsalis. And we'd just sit there drinking tequila sunrises and just soaking in this New Orleans progressive jazz. And one day, and James Black was playing drums for a lot of these sets. And one evening, Ellis stopped the show and he said, I want to bring out a young pianist. This is his, more or less his debut to the New Orleans scene. And I'd like to introduce you to Henry Butler.
Oh, wow.
I mean, I was there for these moments, you know, and then that was so special. And at the same time, you know, starting in high school, going to the Warehouse, which was the greatest rock and roll venue in the South, no question about it. This is where the hippies went. And I remember my first concert at the Warehouse. I was a senior in high school. And I told my mom that I had to go to Tulane Library to work on a term paper.
I have a first time I went to see music, live music in New Orleans, and lied to my parents' story too. But like, go ahead. So you're going to the Howard Chilton Library to
yes.
work on a term paper, and you get on the streetcar and off you go. And
we saw Johnny Winter.
And, oh wow!
Yeah, and Edgar Winter, and it was unbelievable. And I think she later realized what was going on. But we went to the warehouse, so many great concerts, good Lord.
And just to throw it out there, but at that time, did you know the girl who was going around putting up flyers for the warehouse, a certain young Susan Spicer?
Oh, yes. My secret girlfriend. Yeah, we're in the same generation. I didn't know she was doing that.
She told me.
She might have told me that once.
Yeah, I think she told me that she was. She started out, like, the reason she was able to get into the warehouse is that she would go out and put up posters for them.
So, nice.
So she traded that for admission. So
that's so cool.
Did you see the Disastrous Doors show?
I did.
And was it?
Yeah. It was disastrous.
We know being New Orleanians that like a little that a bit of drink is fun and a bit too much leads to sloppiness.
Yeah, there were some moments, you know. I mean, I remember seeing Bob Marley and the Wailers there, man. Wow, that was such a great evening. If you could see the stage, there was so much smoke, but it was great. And I remember we went to see Procol Harum, a wonderful rock group in the 70s, and the opening act was this new group called the Eagles. and just so many, you know, Leon Russell, geez, what a show. Humble Pie, Peter Frampton. But those were great times, and my mother didn't know about many of those visits.
Uh-huh. Now, I want to circle back to Lou and Charlie's for just a second, because I think that's something that's really cool. I met Charlie Baring when he came back and opened up a club called Charlie's in the Warehouse District, and this must have been like late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
But Charlie, for a long time, first of all, he was, and it's very funny just thinking about like how much when we think about New Orleans music, we think about Ernie Cato, and we think about Irma Thomas, and we think about Deacon John, and yes. This is, in case anyone was wondering, in Radioland, I was making a guitar looking sound. But yeah, people think about New Orleans music as the classic New Orleans rhythm and blues, which is all brilliant and wonderful stuff, or we think about brass bands. But, you know, there was a hotbed of modern jazz, and it was Charlie who kind of gave the people the chance to do that. And then Charlie, did he at that time, or does he go on to become one of the people who was like programming all of the jazz for the Jazz Fest?
I think so. Charlie, I would describe him, you know, in one word, as an impresario. He facilitated all this progressive jazz in New Orleans and gave them a home and a venue to play, and worked behind the scenes so much. And he was such a gracious gentleman, generous of heart. And I continued to see him years later at Snug Harbor. We'd run into each other there, seeing Ellis Marsalis or someone at Snug. And, you know, his behind-the-scene work at Jazz Fest was, I think, really instrumental in, you know, keeping the diversity in that program.
Mm-hmm.
And really, speaking of Jazz Fest, some of my favorite memories of Jazz Fest is before the fairgrounds, when we had concerts and the president, the riverboat USS President.
We're going to board the riverboat President as this interview goes on, for sure. So,
yes, that was the highlight to me. And there was some great shows at Municipal Auditorium as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, stop me. Did Idris Muhammad, was he playing in town here before he went to New York? So you got to see, you're giving me an eye. Saw Idris Muhammad. This look in your eyes is like you got to see Idris.
Yes. Oh, my God. What a drummer. He was amazing. The rhythm, the beat, the magic he brought out of a drum set was, it would just reverberate inside of you. He had that kind of power.
Mm-hmm.
And to see him have some success in the big city was really great. We'd start buying albums and, hey, it's Idris Muhammad.
Mm-hmm. Who wound up playing with everybody and on everything.
Yeah. He was kind of like the Johnny Vodakovich of New York City for several years, you know?
Yeah.
And those guys, good Lord, Astral Project.
Oh, yeah.
Wow. Continue to really keep our sound alive.
Now, and this is probably something I'll ask James and Johnny if I ever get them in here, did they start off at Lou and Charlie's and then wind up at Snug, or were they more sort of a...
My recall is Snug.
Okay.
That's where I first encountered them. I there was a time when I lived on Frenchman Street in the early 80s.
Uh-huh.
When
before, this people need to understand this was back when it was an empty street. There was a coffee shop called Until Waiting Fills. and then there was a nascent little club called the Dream Palace. And then down there was one club and it was Snug.
Yeah. And I lived at 714. Frenchman when I worked at K. Paul's for a few years. And that's right. We'd go to Dream Palace to see the Radiators.
So this little rock and roll band that was coming out of Luigi's Pizza on,
right.
on Robert E. Lee?
Robert E. Lee.
Wow. And,
yeah.
Elysian Fields, way out there on Elysian Fields, Luigi's Pizza.
One of my classmates in grade school at St. Matthew the Apostle, Timmy Clary, the late Timmy Clary.
Oh, wow.
He was their manager at Luigi's, and we saw him at Luigi's, too, in high school. It was, I walked to and from work, and I could stop at these clubs on the way home, and, the synergy that James Singleton and Johnny Vodakovich and David Torkanowski, they still got it. And it's I think, also a defining segment of progressive jazz in New Orleans. And they backed up everybody that came to town.
Well, I know for a fact that Mose Allison has a book, and Mose Allison travels the country with drum notation and bass notation, and just some of my favorite Mose Allison shows ever have been the ones with James and Johnny, you know.
So, yeah, I saw some of that. What a brilliant artist.
Yeah. So this is kind of, like brass band wasn't even an exploding scene yet. It was like there were like little, there was brass bands were for functions. If someone died, you'd see, like for me, I grew up on Lower Line Street, and so I was down the street from the Green Street Cemetery. So we'd say, like, why is this band walking down the street? Oh, it's a jazz funeral. Now it's, you know, sort of like so big and ubiquitous. But
that's a good point. And I think it's an example, of which there are several, where we kind of take things for granted.
Yeah.
You know, I grew up here. I'm of a certain age, and brass bands have always been here. And it takes something radical like Hurricane Katrina for us to really appreciate what we have.
Yeah.
And for me, immediately post-Katrina, brass band music and gumbo is what brought me home.
Yeah.
No question. We were, in January of 06, I was on a tour organized by Share Our Strength, the hunger assistance program. Uh-huh. And they organized tours to New Orleans called Hinges of Hope. And they would bring in journalists, financial people, other chefs from around the country, and we'd get on a little bus and just take a tour of New Orleans post-Katrina and see. We went to Dookie Chase and saw Miss Leah. I took them down to Shell Beach to meet some fishermen that were struggling. And then we came back downtown, and we were on Canal Street, and we wanted to show them Bourbon Street. So we got off the bus at Canal and Bourbon, and as we're walking off the bus, there's this brass band on the corner. Jamming. And I just wept. And it turned out to be the Hot Eight.
Oh, wow.
And the brass band sound really meant home to me. And I had a new perspective about it and a new appreciation for it. And I think that's true of a lot of things, restaurants included. We as New Orleanians, after Katrina, were so worried about our culture, the preservation,
it was an emotionally raw time for a lot of reasons. And we were very angry, with good reason,
yes,
about a lot of things.
That's a good description, is raw emotion, because, you know, we could weep at a heartbeat. You know, we took these people into Dookie Chase, for instance, and Miss Leah's in her trailer next door. The restaurant is stripped down to the studs. It stinks because it was so flooded. And starts giving them a tour with this big smile on her face, those beautiful white teeth and that glowing smile, and starts showing them everything in the kitchen, brought them back to the cedar stove. And she said, I didn't do enough. What do you mean, Miss Leah? I didn't do enough for my community. And I lost it. I went outside. I stood in the middle of the street and just stared. There's nobody around. There's nothing mm-hmm. around. It's just desolate.
The little feet, right? Psh, right. Gone. Yeah.
And Bill Shore, the head of Sheriff's Drain, walked up behind me quietly and he said, "The silence is deafening, isn't it?" And I just lost it again. I said, "Yes, it is." Oh, but God. She was this beacon of hope, as she always has been, to carry our culture forward and get the message across that we have great food in New Orleans, we have great music in New Orleans, but it's the people.
Mm-hmm.
The people are what makes this place special.
Yeah. It's the people who make the food and the music. But yes, that we couldn't do it anymore. Wow. Okay, you got me, and I'm supposed to fill the silence, but yeah, I've got to say you're landing on something there for sure.
But I think music and food, you know, we are definitely in the same arena on so many levels and layers. You know, we, you know, celebrate life through food and music.
Mm-hmm.
We make special memories around a table, dining, or in a club, having a life-changing experience listening to James Black.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, we can never lose sight of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there are very specific similarities. And the number one to me is composition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, composing a dish
mm-hmm.
Through taste, texture, the looks of it, the smell of it. All the sensory impacts you're going to create with this one dish. And in a sense, that's the same thing you're doing when you write a song. You know, there's an intro, and then you add this and that, and you take the audience on a ride. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot to be said there, but perhaps...
Here's another one, though. What about timing?
Yes.
What about, okay, so it's like, I'm going to just make it very simple. I'm going to start this potato now, and then in 45 minutes, I'm going to start cooking the hamburger. It's the same kind of thing as you've got an hour playing with the people, and you want to play this up song, and then you want to play the thoughtful song, and then you want to close with the anthemic song. Timing on so many levels. And I mean, and the baked potato and the hamburger, I'm just telling, is the most basic example for the audience and for the layman audience. But I mean, you got to realizing here, I'm just trying to frank, I mean, when you've got like you've got orders and say, what's my all day, and you've got like, you know,
right,
20 plates and all these dishes, or I'm just saying like cooking from home and trying to have everything ready at the same time, you know, it's
well,
a skill.
That's true. You know, I you know, there's a kind of a cliched situation where somebody is a great home cook and they make this, you know, tremendous meal for their guests, and somebody says, "Oh, you should open a restaurant." Well, maybe not.
No.
Because a restaurant kitchen is different in the sense that you're not just making the meal one time.
Mm-hmm.
You're making it thousands of times repetitively. And just as musicians are playing the same song repetitively, and you get to the point where you're not thinking anymore.
Mm-hmm.
It becomes natural.
That's
when you get good.
Yeah.
That's when you can elevate your art, your craft, your experience to a level that only comes with experience. And mm-hmm. in a restaurant kitchen, it's a lot of moving parts, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a large kitchen, like Commander's Palace, perhaps,
mm-hmm.
or Antoine's, perhaps, that's like Duke Ellington's orchestra.
I mean,
you've got all these players and you're trying to play this song together. And, you know, in a smaller kitchen like mine, maybe it's like, I shouldn't even compare, but the Ellis Marsalis Trio or something.
Right.
But you're doing this in a way where you're getting your players involved
mm-hmm.
on time, and play in the right notes
mm-hmm.
and repetitively. And that's our craft.
Yeah. All right, everybody. Welcome to part two of episode 2 of DJ Davis's Tasting Notes, my interview with Frank Brightson. We're going to learn about Commander's Palace, working our way through the stations, the Rolling Stones 1981 tour-ending party on the Riverboat President, cooking for Mr. Bruce Springsteen, keeping it small, soft-shell crabs, and how to cook a good oyster. This segment is brought to you by French Market Coffee and Chicory, the coffee I've been drinking since I was 8. So I have a David Buckingham, who's a visual artist now in Los Angeles. You're okay, but you know what I'm talking about. Said that he was working as a front waiter when this young man in checks shows up wondering where Paul Prudhomme is. So do you want to tell me the story here or fill this in?
Yeah, David and I worked at Commander's together.
Yeah,
I remember him well, and that was, you know, speaking of culinary school. My 6 months at Commander's in the late 70s was my culinary education.
Hmm.
I learned every station in the kitchen. Got to work every station in the kitchen.
So they started you at...
Salads, pantry.
Uh-huh, pantry, and then you moved to hot apps. Or tell me the, if you remember the progression, I'd love to hear it.
Yeah, I remember it clearly. And I tell young chefs this too, and any field really. Like a young chef, you know, just graduated school, mm-hmm. and I'm trying to consult with them about what's next, you know, and, well, pick a restaurant you like and, you know, let's talk about it. Pick a chef you like. And you just spend all this money and time in culinary school. Don't go ask for a sous chef's job.
No.
Don't go ask for $50,000. Get your foot in the door. Find the right place. Get your foot in the door, because you grow through performance and mm-hmm. opportunity.
Okay.
And that's what happened to me. I was working salads. A guy trained me, Steve Gamble. And obviously very busy. We're doing 500, 600, 700 covers a night. And I later realized they didn't tell me it was a two-person station. It was just me.
Oh, man.
So I guess I performed okay. So one day, next to me is the hot appetizer station, which mm-hmm. was mostly baked oysters on the half shell. And the sous chef came over, and the fellow working the hot apps was John. He said, "John, have you been drinking?" And John said, "Well, I had a couple." Sous chef said, "Go home. Frank, you're on hot apps." Okay.
Trial by fire, quite
literally. And so I got to work hot apps, and it was great.
How long do you bake an oyster? Do you have a salamander, or if you're like doing it at home, you're on broil? I've got some.
We do at Brightson's. We have our unique seafood platter that has baked oysters in the half shell, and we do.
We're gonna get to the platter.
15 minutes at 500 degrees.
Okay, and that's about six inch.
Not broiler, but oven.
Okay, oven.
Yeah.
Okay.
500 is banging.
515.
Yep, and they're bubbly hot mm-hmm. At that point. And then one Sunday morning, we did jazz brunch, of course, at Commander's, and I was prepping like 6 cases of strawberries. And the frontline chefs, it was getting close to opening, and the frontline chef said, "Frank, you know how to make an omelet?" I said, "Nope." Well, it turns out the schedule changed, and the two backline sauté chefs didn't show up. So 5 minutes before opening, Jay Blair said, "Frank, you're making omelets." And so I worked backline sauté and learned how to shake a skillet and make omelets and all these things. And it was trial under fire for sure. And I loved it, man. And of course, in those situations, Davis, you know, nobody has the time to stop for 10 minutes and walk you through something. They get you started and you're on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were some mistakes, you know, some omelets hit the grill, but I learned, and they didn't tell me that was a two-man station either. But, you know, that's how, even in music, I'm sure, you know, a band has a gig, somebody's sick.
Mm-hmm.
They got to call somebody.
Coming in to sub for somebody, trial by fire.
Another sax player that can come in tonight?
Right, and they've got some idea. You're like, what key is this in? They have an idea of the form, but then they can, yeah, and then...
And they have this unexpected learning experience that is probably joyful and maybe a springboard to future gigs and stuff. And so
I had a chance to work with a drummer who, for the first time just last week because of one situation or another, needing a sub, and he had such big ears, and it was such a pleasure. Like, actually, he played slightly different feels on some of the songs, and I was like, that's actually a good idea. Like, I've done this song for 15 years, and I never thought of doing it that way.
Nice.
It's just, like, enough to, like, open your ears. So,
and that's how arts are passed, really, by this personal sharing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I was at Commanders, we didn't have any recipes. Creole cuisine has been passed down. Brass band music has been passed down for 100 years plus, one-on-one.
Yeah.
From generation to generation. And it's a precious thing, even more precious thing because of that.
I want to move us, if we can, back to the Riverboat President.
Ah.
So my, being younger than you, some of my favorite, so the first... the first concert I got really high at was Peter Tosh, Mama
wow.
Africa Tour in 1984, the Ramones, Gary Numan and We Were Mad Mean to the opening band, which was Wall of Voodoo. But it was the 80s. But I want to talk a little bit about the Rolling Stones party on the Riverboat President, because I'm just trying to get.
How'd you know about that?
Being a bit younger, I will tell you. So the first Rolling Stones album I actually bought with babysitting money was Some Girls, and we were huge about the Some Girls. We really loved this record. I'm like, Mom, let us go see the Rolling Stones. It's like, well, those tickets are $11.50. I don't think you have the money for it. But no, Mom, we'll figure it out. Let's go see the Rolling Stones. And she was like, I'm not going to let you go to the Superdome unsupervised to see the Rolling Stones. These people will kill you for a bead. No, you're not going to go. So I didn't get to go. But I hear stories. You had mentioned on social medias or something about how you were actually a chef. So the Rolling Stones, to fill everybody in, the Rolling Stones, it's at 81, and they're playing.
That's about right.
They're playing in the Superdome. Opening acts were, I don't know, probably Stevie Wonder, the Meters, or someone incredible, and they had a private party. On so the Rolling Stones, like a lot of musicians world over, have a certain reverence and appreciation for New Orleans music. And so it's funny, sort of like the, Paul McCartney has Professor Longhair play on the Queen Mary. And, because Paul McCartney's heard of Professor Longhair, not that Fess has ever heard of the Beatles. So there was a private party on the Riverboat President. And can we take it from there?
Yeah, that was wild. It might have been the end of their tour, I believe, and they hired Chef Paul Prudhomme and Kay Pauls to cater a private party on the Riverboat President. And wow, what an event. We worked for a week on this party. Gosh, I took a lot of drugs.
Now, the reason why I wanted to have you in here, because I've heard from other people who, Ivan Neville, James Singleton, blah, 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 that people didn't really eat a lot because, they were all like,
well,
I'm tapping my nose. But was you tell me, if you were serving the food, you could tell me better than anyone else.
I know I was high. That was that was my era.
Right.
But my job for the party, I was up on the Captain's Bridge, and Chef Paul and Kay assigned me one waitress, Marcia, and our sole job was to take care of Mick Jagger and Keith Richards. And so we did. And we had, I don't know, maybe three or four dishes. But they were eating for sure, because they sent Marcia back up three times to get more crab meat enchiladas.
Oh, wow.
With tomatilla sauce. So they loved it, and it was a trip. So I was up on the bridge, and I missed everything else. I don't know what was going on downstairs, but it must have been special. And it was a memorable, memorable experience. It truly was. I mean, gosh, what an honor. And yeah. I love, I think maybe You know, one of the real joys of having Brightson's Restaurant for almost 38 years now is getting to meet so many wonderful people. And Bruce Springsteen in particular became a good friend. He and Patty, their road manager for many years, Max, is a New Orleanian. He lives here. And so they came to eat with us several times. And one year, the E Street Band was having their farewell tour, their first farewell tour. And Max called me up and arranged to fly me up to New York. Marna came with me to cook for the band after their show at Madison Square Garden. Oh, wow. And this was the second to last show. So we went up. And I brought, you know, boxes and boxes of food. I knew what he liked. I brought soft shell crabs, all kinds of goodies. And after the show, it was pushing 1 o'clock, 12:30, 1 o'clock. They came to the hotel, and I prepared dinner for the band members and their spouses and girlfriends. So it was like 12 of them, and it was so cool. Afterwards, I just kind of peeked into the ballroom where they were, and they had a boombox sitting on the table, and they were all just dancing, you know, with their loved ones, and it was just so beautiful. And then the next night for the final show, Max had us backstage passes and front row seats.
Oh, nice.
For Bruce Springsteen and the E Street Band. And backstage, I was in the area where they had food and stuff, and I met Dave Marsh, the great Rolling Stone writer, and it was incredible.
Wow.
And those connections, I think, always stay with us, you know. You never know, and I tell my staff this, you know, you never know what's going to happen. You know, here I am sitting in Treme doing a podcast with Davis Rogan. Who knows what's going to come out of this? You just never know. The last podcast I did was last fall. I did one, it's called Great Minds. And the guy that does that passed it on to Michelle Miller at CBS, and I wound up doing CBS Saturday Morning with her.
No kidding.
Yeah. So you just never know where it's like a spider web. Mm-hmm. You know, you just keep pushing it out there, and you never know where it's going to lead.
I wanted to talk a little bit about it. I think it's kind of interesting about Brightson's and just the idea of just being happy and centered on something that's kind of small scale, because there must have been a time, you know, in the 80s or the 90s where you might have had a chance to, you know, have a Brightson's on the North Shore and a Brightson's on 30A and a Brightson's in Houston, and you could have franchised or had a big place doing 500 plates or covers, and instead to, like, take a shotgun house in the Black Pearl neighborhood and just sort of set up a kitchen and what is it, 25, 30 seats and stuff?
We seat about 50.
50, okay.
Yep.
Slightly bigger, but still, this is in terms of volume.
Still the same.
It's very intimate.
Yes. 38 yeah. years later, it's still the same. And yes, we did have a lot of opportunities. We looked at a lot of properties that were offered to us. You know, there were one or two that I would have gotten if the deal was right, but it wasn't. I had an opportunity to do franchising with one of the biggest restaurant chain groups in America. And we talked about that for 6 months. And at the very end, I was told how much traveling would be involved, and I said, kill it.
Yeah.
I don't want to do it. And the guy, one of the owners, told me the next day, he said, called me and said, Frank, I can't believe you turned this down for that little joint. And that's what I realized. I made the right decision.
Right. It's that little joint.
This
that's your
little
home.
Joint is my happy place, and there's 20 wonderful people that work here.
Yes. There you go.
He didn't get it. Yeah, I could be a multimillionaire, but would I be happy?
Nah. I think it's really
I'm still
nice.
A working stiff, but I'm a happy working stiff.
with 100% control, with 100, 120% control over where it goes, when you serve, what you serve. That's a lot to be said for that.
I'm satisfied. I really am. I'm very content with what I do, and Maureen and I are recommitted to keeping it going. We made that recommitment last year.
Yeah. After the plague.
Yeah, exactly. And hitting retirement age, whatever that is.
Yeah.
But no, we're going to keep it going, man.
Well, I'll be back. Now, I wanted to talk a little bit about, so the Gulf Seafood Platter always meant a lot to me. So talk a little bit about how that came to be.
Yeah, it's really cool. Back in the 90s, we used to do something we called the early evening special. And it's an early bird special, you know, three-course menu, $18.95, whatever it was, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday. Mm-hmm. And then I wanted to do something on Fridays, different. And, you know, New Orleans, Friday seafood.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't have a fry station mm-hmm. at my kitchen. Mm-hmm. So I had to, and most of my best ideas come from having to.
Mm-hmm.
Circumstances, something happens, situations. That's where my best ideas come from. So I created a seafood platter, which everybody in New Orleans loves, but nothing fried.
Which is kind of amazing, because it's like we do love our fried stuff.
Yeah, I do
sometimes,
too.
But sometimes you want to like make slightly more healthier choice on occasion.
Right. And this can be more interesting, too,
mm-hmm.
because it's a specific format, but it's not set in stone. It changes with the seasons or mm-hmm. my whims or any ideas I come up with.
Well, here's what I'm just going to throw out there. This is like almost like shop talk, remember, but do you do, how do you do, or what do you think of soft shell crabs not fried? Because I've been sauteing them myself for a while, and I'm just, because you know, Stephanie doesn't like it fried. It's a little too heavy, you know?
Right. Yeah, it can get very heavy.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, if it's like breadcrumbs or cornmeal,
mm-hmm.
it's too heavy.
Yeah.
Sometimes
I'll just take the soft shell crab and I'll cut the parts out, and then I'll just get some peanut oil, super hot, right? I'm just going to put it on the shell side down for mm-hmm. for about 3 minutes until it starts to plump up around the outside, and then I'm just going to flip it, and then a little bit of white wine and a little bit of butter. That's just how I do it.
But boom. When's it going to be ready? No, I like that. You know, I think the soft shell crab is such a unique thing. It's
mm-hmm.
To me, and it's like catfish too, I only like fried catfish.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like catfish any other way.
No, I don't like, yeah.
But soft shell crab, you know, as long as you're using high heat,
mm-hmm.
Whether it's battered, floured, or not,
mm-hmm.
To kind of get some crispiness, but some firm texture on that shell.
Right.
You're treating it right. It's a gift from nature, you know, and I think we do flour, egg wash, flour. It's
okay.
A double batter, but it's not heavy. It's not like the fish or cornmeal type batters,
right.
And breadcrumbs and stuff like that. That's too much.
For the soft shell crab.
It's a delicate thing.
Oysters, too.
Yeah, exactly. I'll eat an oyster any way you got it. That's my favorite food.
Yeah. What about Tyler's, then?
Oh.
And the 10-cent oyster.
Dude, James Rivers Movement.
Yes.
That's where I fell in love with raw oysters.
Well, for 10 cents a pop, you could afford to, right?
My dad loved raw oysters, and he mm-hmm. would all, at Charlie Seafood, a restaurant I later owned,
mm-hmm.
He would always, you know, here, Frankie, try this, and I gag. I liked mm-hmm. them fried.
Fried was my gateway.
And then one evening, I was at Tyler's Beer Garden listening to James Rivers Movement, drinking mm-hmm. a long neck beer.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, give me some oysters. And I just fell in love with them. And
yeah.
I like them just plain, nothing on them. Just mm-hmm. psh, au naturel.
Right.
I do love cocktail sauce. After my oysters, I'll eat crackers and cocktail sauce.
Yeah. A little way to follow up on that. I think It's nice also what the seafood platter utilizes Gulf seafood. I read a really scary article in the New Yorker magazine about just like the Chinese fishing industry and overfishing this and overfishing that and the working conditions of the people who have to do that and farmed, you know, how bad farming is for the environment. And you can taste, you know, you taste a wild river salmon and a salmon that was farmed in Thailand, and it is night and day.
Totally
different. But I just sort of like,
You have to be knowledgeable about seafood because mm-hmm. it's a very complex world and it's constantly changing. It's the most volatile market there is. As a home consumer or a restaurant chef, knowledge is power and building good relationships is so critical.
Okay, everybody, welcome to part three of Tasting Notes. DJ Davis interviews Chef Frank Brightson. We learn about the maple leaf, Hank Staples, how to cook black drum, cooking tips during the pandemic, good stuff. This segment is brought to you by Sousafunk Records, celebrating the release of All That's first record, eponymous debut, re-released on 180-gram vinyl with new liner notes by Davis Rogan and some photographs that you haven't seen for a while. And it's just a great-looking record. It's available at the Mushroom Records. It's available at Euclid Records. It's available at the Louisiana Music Factory. You can also order it from the Louisiana Music Factory, and you can order it from the website, which is davisrogan.com, keeping in mind that the distribution guy for Sousafunk Records is also me, and sometimes it takes me a while to mail it. You might want to get it from the Music Factory. But anyway, eponymous debut, All That, 180-gram vinyl. Meanwhile, let's finish out our interview with Chef Frank Brightson. Here we go. Being Brightsons, you are just around the corner from a very hallowed spot, and you were talking about lying to your parents about studying to write a paper so you could go to your first concert at the Warehouse. So it was freshman year at Ben Franklin, and I lied to my parents about a babysitting gig. And here's one that kind of gets people excited, but then I kind of disappoint them or confront them. But anyway, I lied to my parents about a babysitting gig, and I went to Oak Street to see some music. It was the last night that James Booker ever played at the Maple Leaf. James Booker's last night at the Maple Leaf. And I was 14 years old. So I was across the street checking out the Butthole Surfers opening up for the Dead Kennedys.
At Jed's?
Yes. I was across the street at Jed's checking out the punk rock band. So yeah, you know, having been in that spot, Brighton's, for a while, we could talk about the Maple Leaf. We could also kind of talk about that amazing time when there was like an intersection. So there was Jed's/Muddy Water or Tupelo's, Jed's, Muddy Waters, and then
Jimmy's
and the Maple Leaf and Carrollton Station.
Yep.
Yeah. And
very
a scene and a half, really.
Very hip scene. Yeah. And when I moved back to New Orleans from LSU in 77, mm-hmm. I got a beautiful apartment on Maple Street. Mm. At Cherokee, right across from Phillips.
Okay.
And I just noticed, by the way, it's for rent. But anyways, my roommate and I, who I grew up with, grade school friend, would go like down, just walk down the street and have beers and play pinball at the college bars and stuff. But our entertainment was either Tipitina's or Tyler's Beer Garden mm-hmm. or Maple Leaf. And yes, we saw James Booker there. Oh my God, what a magician. And later, I believe I saw John Cleary's first concert at Maple Leaf.
He was 17 years old and he was living in the back, and they gave him an apartment if he was painting the exterior.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I did a gig with John Cleary last year. It was a fundraiser for NOCA.
Oh wow.
Where I have taught for many years, and it was in someone's home on St. Charles, and I did the food, and John did the music, solo piano in somebody's living room.
Oh, wow.
So he was in the back, like in the pool house, you know, that was his green room, and I brought him dinner, he and his partner, and we had a lovely conversation, a lot of fun, really fun guy. And but anyway, Maple Leaf, you know, the rads
at the Maple Leaf.
Oh my God, are you kidding?
Yeah.
And I saw Earl Turbinton at Jed's. The one time I went to Jed's, we went over there to see Earl Turbinton, who we loved. And about halfway through the set, I don't want to besmirch anyone's memory, but Jed came over and kicked us out. Because we were only on our second beer or something, you know. Yeah, I'm not here to cater to hippies. Get the hell out of here, you know, whatever. But Maple Leaf and what Hank still does on Oak Street is so remarkable. I can't tell you how many wonderful experiences I've had. It's only three or four, really, but guests come to dine at Brightson's, and they're visitors. And we randomly begin chatting in the hall or something. And I'm like, where are y'all going next? Well, we're going to Maple Leaf. You know, we can just walk over, huh? Well, I said, well, it's 9:30. I'm getting ready to go. I'll give you a ride.
Nice.
Jump in the Suburban, and I give them a ride. I made the best friends. And the last time I did that was a Jazz Fest night. Two ladies from Connecticut, really fun. And so I drove them over to Maple Street. We parked, and Jack from Giacomo's is outside grilling oysters.
Yep.
And I helped them get into Maple Leaf because it was sold out and stuff. Hank is such a great neighborhood treasure.
He really is.
You know, what he went through with Katrina, protecting his property and stuff like that. And he'll come eat and just sit in the hall by himself and have dinner. And his thing is to write you a free pass on a BevNap. A cocktail napkin, just sign it here. Just put this, hand that at the door to get into the club. Oh, but in those 70s, in my college years, Maple Leaf had a thing called Suds and Duds. They had a laundromat set up in one of the rooms. And so I'd bring my laundry over there and, you know, start drinking beers, of course, and then stay for the show, Rebirth, whatever was going on. Such an intimate room, and God, you know, that old saying, if walls could talk, Maple Leaf has it.
One that pops in my mind, Exuma.
Oh, my God.
Exuma, the Obeah Man.
Oh, my God.
At the Maple Leaf. That was some shows.
Wow. I forgot about him. I saw him many times.
Yeah. And Benny's Bar, too, I'm sure.
Yeah. I took... here's a Bruce Springsteen story for you. So one night, Bruce and Patty and Max were at the restaurant, and his late bodyguard, Terry, who was a great guy. So after dinner, Max said, you want to go out? And I said, sure. So Bruce Springsteen and Patty and Max and Terry and I and Marna, Max said, where should we go? I said, well, let's go to Maple Leaf. So we went to Maple Leaf, and the band playing was called NOBD, New Orleans Blues Department.
Holy smokes, haven't heard that name in a minute.
Yes, my good friend Michael. And we sat there and watched him play, and Bruce got up and played with him. He played Mustang Sally. And then we went to Benny's Beach Ball after.
Beach Ball Benny's. Not Beach Ball Benny's, not to be confused with Benny's, though.
Yes. Okay. That's right. Thank you. So, yeah, I got to go out with Bruce Springsteen.
Yes.
We were prowling the town.
That's posh. It's sort of funny. I've heard all of those Bruce Springsteen was here and sat in their stories. I didn't realize it was that you were rolling with. So
he was such a cool guy. Yeah,
still is.
Such a cool guy, and just down to earth and friendly, you know, and appreciative of everything you do.
And Stevie, his guitar player, is Steve Van Zandt, is a real appreciator of music and music history.
Yes.
And he has a. He has a great educational thing called Teach Rock. He's got some stuff on his website.
I know he does good things.
Oh, yeah.
We got to pass it on, y'all.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the whole key. Don't die with it. You know, everyone deserves a chance. Yeah. Young people need opportunity. And that's why I taught. I'm kind of retired from it now, but I taught 17 years up at Nichols State at the John Foss Culinary Institute, and that was a post-Katrina thing. Oh, okay. I wanted to preserve our culture. I called them up. I said, can I come teach?
Wow.
And When
that was very evident, you know, during like I was just saying during the plague, is that you had some live stuff on social media where you're like, this is a dish and this is a dish I'm making, and just sort of talking through it. And I really enjoyed watching that. And what was cool too is you said, because it was dangerous to go out, like you were, so you're like, I'm using this and I'm using that because I'm using what's in my pantry
cooker.
I need you to find what you've got, yes, and you're going to work with that.
That's exactly right. I was doing cooking demos from my house,
mm-hmm,
and putting them on social media or with Fox 8. My friends over there did a lot of it. And that was the whole thing, pantry cooking. And I came up with some good recipes out of that. But, you know, restaurant chefs don't get to cook at home.
No.
And during lockdown, it was my wife and I, and we cooked together for 4 months.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really fun. For 3 months.
All right. So two things. One is, give me your how to grill a perfect piece of fish. I have a 12-ounce fillet of black drum and go.
Right. Well, if you're talking about grilling and fish in particular.
Uh-huh. Pan searing, maybe.
Pan searing. Okay. Yeah. Even better.
Okay.
Don't be afraid of the fire. Fire creates flavor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with fish, you want to sear it. Some people call it a hard sear. Mm-hmm. I call it a deep sear.
Okay, so my thoughts, some of the things, and tell me if I'm, okay, now I'm going to tell you what I do, and you can tell me if I'm right or wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
But like what I do is, I take my pan, and I put the heat under it, and I just want the pan just for a minute, 2 minutes at least, just to get the heat. You want the pan hot, hot, before I even add in the oil.
Yeah.
I get the pan hot, hot, hot. It's just as crank as much as your home stove will go, right? And then I'm going to use a little bit of oil. I go peanut because it can, it goes at a higher temperature, but yep. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, well, that's how we do it at home. Okay. We, you know, like my mom, there's always a cast iron skillet on the stove.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when we do cook at home more or not, it's usually on a Sunday night, and we'll make something pretty simple, uh-huh, often seared fish.
Uh-huh.
And we heat up the cast iron skillet. I keep it skillet dry.
Uh-huh.
But on a plate, I'll take my fish fillet and season it.
Right.
And just drizzle it with some oil.
Okay. So, but you can take the fish. Okay. Now, so fish, wash it, clean it.
Yes. Wash it.
Pat it very dry.
Yes. Very dry. And then
season it both
sides, end to end.
Okay.
So that every bite's the same.
Okay.
And I just drizzle it with a little oil. You're not frying, you're searing.
Okay.
And once you put the fish in the skillet, don't fool with it.
Right.
Let it sit.
Mm-hmm. 3 minutes?
Well, you can't use the clock.
Don't use the clock, okay.
Like, it's just like barbecuing.
Okay.
How long are you going to cook those steaks? You don't use the clock.
Ah.
A fish like that on top of the stove, seared, grilled, it will tell you when to turn it. You'll start to see white edges,
yes,
on the edge.
Uh-huh.
And then take your spatula and just nudge the fish. If the fish moves, uh-huh, it's seared. If it's still sticking, it's not ready.
Take the handle and give it a little shake, or
yeah,
nudge it with the... Okay.
If once the fish is seared, it'll move easily.
Yeah.
Then turn it.
Okay.
And then usually with a normal size fish fillet, probably 3 minutes on the other side.
Yeah.
Fish is done when you can put your finger through it, but don't put your finger through it.
No.
That's called the mark of excellence.
Ah, right. Okay, no fingers.
But you can take a knife, like a steak knife. if the knife goes in easily, if there's resistance, it's still raw in the middle.
Okay. That's good. And then you let that sit or...
No, I would eat it right away.
Yeah, okay.
We like to do simple vegetables with it,
uh-huh,
like sautéed spinach.
Mm-hmm.
Buy that whole big thing of spinach at the store, and that's enough for two servings.
Yeah, you just want to, it looks big, and you're just going to take it all the way down.
Or I really like also roasted cauliflower.
Mm. So tell us how you're roasting cauliflower.
I got a recipe for that.
Okay.
Heat your oven to 500 degrees. Big skillet. Break down your cauliflower into florets, pretty good size ones.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to take a lot of oil. When the skillet is hot, a large skillet, put a generous amount of oil. I use mild olive oil. Mm-hmm. Add the cauliflower and just saute it until it begins to brown. Season it with whatever you like, salt and pepper, and then put it in that 500-degree oven for exactly 10 minutes. And when it comes out, it's kind of charred and crunchy, but tender and delicious. Fire creates flavor.
Yes.
And that charring in the high heat is really what makes it delicious. And you can do broccoli the same way, but it really does.
Broccoli goes a little quicker.
Yes.
Cauliflower has a little more resistance, so you can spend a little more time.
And I'll do, you know, different vegetables in separate skillets sometimes, you know, like diced eggplant. I love eggplant.
Yeah.
And then mix them after they're cooked because the cooking time's a little different.
Things are different, yeah.
Yeah. And you can, you know, if I have a combo like that, I'll often make I call it a pantry Asian sauce. Mm-hmm. I'll take a little bowl and see what you got in your pantry. Mm-hmm. I'll add some tamari or soy sauce. Mm-hmm. I have some sushi ginger in the fridge in a jar, mm-hmm. Garlic, a little lime, and maybe some chili paste, and mix that up. And then toss your roasted vegetables in that. Oh, so good. And wow. So simple.
Yeah. Sometimes it is the simplest thing. Now, the thing I've been doing also a lot of times is I'll sear one side, and then I'll flip it. And then that's where I'll come with a generous amount of cheap white wine.
Nice.
And I let that go down. And then when that's starting to bubble down, that's when I add just a little bit of butter.
Perfect.
Like the French butter. And you just wait until... So the sauce, it's like as soon as the water part of the wine starts to boil off, it's
right.
just... The
essence.
Yeah. And then the butter's kind of a little
nice.
Brown.
It's nice. It's kind of like a quick braise.
Yeah. I call it like a pan beurre blanc.
Like yeah. Like, I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. Nice technique.
Okay, so what's another sauce? Give me some other good simple home sauce for you.
That sauce is also one I like to put on top of fish.
Okay.
I do what I call pan roasting. Mm-hmm. And again, 500-degree oven. Don't be afraid of the fire. And I will take like your fish fillet of drum, mm-hmm. season it, make a little seasoned flour, and just flour the bottom side of the fillet, just the bottom. And then heat up some oil on the skillet, put that floured side down first.
Right.
Let it brown and sear, and then finish it in that oven. It won't take long, 7-8 minutes probably.
Okay.
And then when it's almost done, take that tamari, ginger, garlic, chili paste mixture and baste the top of the fish with that.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
Nice.
Delish.
Okay, well,
Frank's pantry fish. That's what I call that.
This is. I'm now.
And you got all this stuff in your pantry. See what you got.
Right. No need to run to the store.
No. One more place just occurred to me.
Uh-huh.
Oh, my God. Rosie's.
Ah.
Right?
I was a little young for that, but I've heard the stories.
Oh, my God. Rosie's. On Chapatulas, the building still there, was a special place. It was a plush jazz club. And I didn't know Rosie, but the story was Rosie, she was an heiress. She inherited some money.
Yeah, she came into some money and she felt like doing a club right.
Yeah, and she was an aspiring jazz vocalist is what the story I heard. So she put a lot of money into this club, a beautiful two-story building. And I mean, big plush chairs to sit in, tables. It was a jazz club. And brought in the best jazz artist in the country. I remember seeing Flora Purim and Ayerto. Stan Getz.
Wow.
And my friend Eddie and I, we went and saw Max Roach, the drummer.
Oh, wow.
With 12 people in the room. It was sad.
That's criminal.
It was sad.
Yeah.
But I must have gone there 30 times. Just incredible music. In the most incredible
There's a Meters Live at Rosie's. So the Meters.
Oh, my God, yes. Well, you know, in the 70s, tips meant the Meters.
Yeah.
You know, Fess, of course.
Yeah. Well, for me,
but
I think
those meter shows at Tips in the 70s, that was the pinnacle of New Orleans music to me.
Yeah.
The funk.
Yeah.
The neighborhood funk. The culture, the people, the beat.
Yeah.
If you couldn't have fun at that show, you're ill.
I guess my 1972-73 story for me was we're at the Chapel of the Holy Spirit on Broadway, on corner of Broadway and Simple, maybe? Okay, and so they release us to go to Sunday school. And they're sending us out to Sunday school for the sermon. I'm like six, 7 years old. And I'm walking out. And across the street, there's a stage outside of the Boot. And it's the Meters with the Wild Chapatulas.
Oh,
and it was like, Sunday school or the Meters? And I was like, forget this. I'm going to hell. You know, I was like, cross Broadway and saw that band.
And that's a New Orleans thing. I mean, that's you could turn a corner and see a miracle.
Yeah. And we're all starting it young, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we grew up with it.
We grew up with it, and I like what you're saying, and now time to pass it on, you know?
We got to. You can't let pieces of our culture die. You know, the world has changed so much since I was a young man. I'm 69 years old.
Wow.
And people are, you know, they're on their phones. They're on their phones, and they're missing the sensual part of parts of our culture, and we have to remind them how important it is. And you know,
put down the phone.
There's incredible artists and people walking down our streets, you know, and we gotta keep that spirit alive.
Appreciate what we have.
Yep, always.
Because we've got something.
I'm the luckiest guy in town.
Well, Frank, thanks so much for coming by the mansion in the ghetto, seeing this is the birthplace of the brass band revolution right here, and now just a great chance to have a chat with you. And Stephanie and I will come see you real soon.
I appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah.
And sitting in this plush, historic room is very special, too.
Well, there you have it, folks. Episode number 2 of DJ Davis's Tasting Notes. Massive thanks to Chef Frank Brightson for coming out and speaking with me, taking the time. That was a real honor. I want to dedicate this episode to John Sinclair. John Sinclair, the cannabis activist, manager of the MC5, and a bit of a mentor to me at WWOZ back in the 90s. I was listening to the radio the other day, and I heard the John Lennon song, John Sinclair. And sure enough, he'd just passed away, so sorry to see him go, but thanks for all the time he gave us, and I've definitely got some John Sinclair stories for y'all for sure. Okay, my website, if you want to check out my music or order my record or my CDs, is davisrogan.com. If you'd like to email me regarding the show, that's that email is tastingnotes@davisrogan.com. Tasting Notes is produced and edited by Scott Freelo. Our intro and outro songs are written and performed by Davis Rogan. As always, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Blue Plate Mayonnaise, for bringing it all together. So, this is DJ Davis saying, thanks for tuning in. You have great taste.